And welcoming you, dear listeners, to this Friday edition of the Business and Economics segment here on your number one talk radio station. And primarily as we head into the potential weekends, the weekend that is dawning upon us, and primarily also factoring into how the weekend actually follows on right after the public holiday that was just yesterday. Obviously, this is important because when you look at this particular indication of the spirit within which we find ourselves in this particular week, I have to actually point you towards a particular development. But it's not a development because it's actually been a long-standing particular concern that actually emanates from the regional bloc, that's SADC. And you know, it's a discussion primarily that has been thought of for a very long time. Now, this is a specific notion, but that actually speaks towards what we've been covering for so long. Now, before we actually start with our discussion, just to remind you, dear listeners, you can listen to us on the Eagle FM application on your regular radio set, or primarily also through the Eagle FM website, when you can actually stream either our direct live broadcasts or, you know, access our podcasts for that matter, in terms of just for any historical reference and probably something that you might have missed. So, dear listeners, I position today's particular talk because it actually coincides with a particular sentiment and the discussion that I had on Thursday, obviously on Independence Day, that being of the definition of happiness and how do you look at happiness, and obviously the covering of the happiness economics or the economics of happiness primarily in yesterday's discussion, which also piggybacks on the particular development and the youth unemployment protest of yesterday, the planned one here in the capital. And the single most important thing to factor in from this, dear listeners, is the SADC region. This is now our particular talk for today. The SADC region has actually been highlighting primarily how youth unemployment is a factor for instability and potentially the aspect of being a security threat to the region. I'm not making this up, dear listeners, primarily because this is something that has been spoken about to great length by many scholars across the continent and in other parts of the world as well. But this is important primarily because this is one of the few times actually where mention was made of the importance of youth and the systems primarily to try and assist them, or that the aspect of the fear of youth dissent, well, not dissent, but more like youth frustrations actually becoming or boiling over primarily in countries. Now, I take you to a recent particular contribution that came through from the SADC, from a recent SADC gathering that took place in Luanda, Angola. This particular gathering was at the opening ceremony of the Ordinary SADC Council of Ministers meeting, and it was actually the remarks of the SADC Executive Secretary, that being Mr. Elias Makhosi, and this was, as I mentioned, held in Luanda, Angola, on 10 March, just 2 weeks back, basically. So, the excerpt that I'm going to read to you primarily comes in where Mr. Mahosi, you know, goes through all the particular detailed accounts of, you know, the work of SADC in the region and the particular events, which include also the death of a few, you know, SADC military mission soldiers in parts of Africa or parts of SADC. And he starts by indicating, primarily by saying, allow me to talk to the issue of youth. While much has been done at the member state level, there is currently no comprehensive regional program for youth, yet they constitute a large portion of our population. This, if not addressed, could pose a security threat to the region. He says, your meeting, dear ministers, provides an opportunity to bring renewed hope for young people in our region by prioritizing the needs of the youth to become partners in building peace, security, and prosperity in our region. Based upon that particular notion, he highlights also in the next particular paragraph from his speech by mentioning that the speeding up of regional integration is key in order to achieve the shared or the regional goals of SADC, primarily by mentioning, as regards operationalizing programs of regional integration, the Secretariat has noted the slow pace of signing and ratifying SADC protocols and legal instruments by member states. Signing the approved legal instruments provides a framework for fostering cooperation and collaboration towards attaining our shared objectives and aspirations. So, leaving it on that particular note, dear listeners, obviously to indicate to you the clarion call to find particular clear-cut, you know, solutions on a regional level for the question of the youth demographics across the SADC block, has actually also reached the regional level in terms of that this has to be factored into. Now, at this particular junction, it was also in the same time span primarily as the unveiling of Namibia's population demographics, the preliminary results. Once again, just to resuscitate your memory banks about it, these particular indications, obviously, from the presentation that was done by, or the preliminary report that was done by the Statistician General, is significant because we realized we've got 71% of Namibians that live, no, not live. But 71% of Namibians that are below the age of 35 out of the 3 million. That's predominantly, to be exact, 71%. Namibia has a equal distribution of rural and urban populations. Namibia has a 6.8% illustration of people above 60, which literally indicates to you that there is a lot of people in terms of the imbalance. Why I call it an imbalance is primarily because the aspect with regards to this particular indication of Namibia's population development or Namibia's population growth is that we are experiencing a population bulge in the youth brackets pertaining to our particular population expansion. So, the single most important thing that we've got to point out from this, and primarily when I indicate this, is that when we are looking at the aspects of what is literally the indications with regards to the population spread and Namibia's population density. There was actually two reports that I'm also going to cite and reference in our discussion for the day. Two reports I'm going to cite, and these two reports is actually, one is a working paper, was a working paper by the World Bank Group, and then the other was a very short and summarized report by the National Planning Commission that was, because they reference actually information from 2016 to be exact. Primarily, they reference information from 2016, so it was, you know, just after 2016, this particular report, so it could be 2016, 2017, there is no exact date on this short summarized information report by, that is found on the National Planning Commission's website. So, the Namibian report of from the National Planning Commission is titled "The Untapped Resource: Analyzing the Youth Unemployment in Namibia." Now, this specific short report literally confirmed what the Namibia Statistics Agency confirmed through the census, that Namibia has one of the youngest and fastest growing populations in SADC. 62% of the working age adults in the country as at 2016 of this report, not as at like Namibia's 2023 census when they looked at this in 2016. 62% of the working age adults in the country were between the ages of 15 and 34 back then. Now, this working group is widely considered as the youth, and projections about this particular cluster of Namibians indicated that the number of 15 to 24-year-olds will be doubling as by 2045. Now, this indicates literally that a youthful population constitutes a crucial resource. That means they will be there to take on the future jobs. They will be there to factor in for any new jobs to continuously come through. They will be there for any particular new developments that have to be, you know, that have to leverage on their particular availability and skill sets that they can actually, bring to the fore or actually make available. But in the same breath that the report highlights, you know, all these promising elements, they indicate without sufficient job prospects, it is a resource that will continue to remain untapped. Now, dear listeners, when you're thinking about untapped resources, and this has been the particular song we've been singing for in this particular week only in this week, it's been a pretty clear song in its own right. Because we continue to look at things and then we realize they are low-hanging fruits. Yes, I don't like the term still, but they are low-hanging fruits. In some cases, the fruits have already fallen from the tree. They're on the ground. They're on the floor. It's just for someone to pick them up. Now, that's the same particular thing also with untapped resources that are not being utilized. Back in 2016, primarily, we had 43.4% of Namibia's youth that were unemployed, according to this particular report. This indicated that it was nearly three times as many as the global average. And what was an even greater concern was that youth unemployment in the country appeared to continuously rise. And this obviously is true with the particular sentiments that have come through from this youth this youth unemployment demonstration in the capital that was being held for 21 March, obviously that being yesterday. And the youth unemployment demonstration singularly illustrates the problem that exists. That there are Namibians that have not seen the particular opportunity for employment. That there are Namibians that don't have the means to start a business. No matter how young they are, no matter or potentially what particular avenues they might have, they don't have this opportunity primarily. And I'm also going to factor in a few things that the African Development Bank has looked at in their 2013 report about, the aspects of unemployment or unemployed youth in this particular discussion. Now, this is touted as potentially leading to the occurrence or the potential, the occurrence of widespread personal misfortune for individuals and also a lost opportunity for critical national and global economic development. Why? If you look at critical national and global development, well, this literally means that a country like Namibia would be sitting with a resource of human capital that is not doing anything, or they're not part of particular systems and processes in the economy. If you remember back to the particular discussion with the happiness discussion back on Thursday, I asked the particular question of, is it just the government's responsibility to create employment? Is it just their responsibility? You know? But is it also a notion that the private sector also has to roll up their arms or their sleeves, and they've also got to get involved a lot more in terms of generating and contributing to the alleviation prospects of the youth unemployment discussion? I'll make mention of this because I'm not going to factor in these particular indications is the promise of, you know, innovation or innovative ideas in an economy. Now, innovation and innovative ideas in an economy actually speaks to avenues also where people can achieve gainful employment in a country, obviously with the opportunity, if they're given the opportunity, to make a decent living from it. Now, why am I illustrating it as a decent living only? Well, factor this in, dear listeners. Everybody wants to buy a house, right? Everybody wants to buy a car, right? Everybody wants to marry, settle down. I'm not speaking primarily of people 35 to 15 in that particular bracket. Everybody wishes to also go on a holiday. They wish to save up. They wish to earn money. They wish to help family members wherever they can. So there is this continued shared, prospect or goal or ideal or, just this altruistic, inclination that they wish to achieve this in order to contribute here, which is good because it literally factors into the happiness discussion that I spoke about just yesterday. Why do I speak about it? Because these are particularly some of the factors that were also weighted, that were also measured. You see, dear listeners, if you look at a notion of frustration, and as mentioned, the national planning report that I've got here in front of me highlights personal misfortune for individuals and lost opportunity. Means that as people grow older, obviously you move out of a certain age bracket. And as you become older, obviously you would no longer be considered as part of a specific age bracket which would be desirable for first-time employment. That is one of the particular threats. As you become older, you obviously see that the continual rise of services, the continuous rise of goods around you does not stop. It will actually push you into a corner. It's a very aggressive, but it's also a very sad progressive indication that is very, 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 very stressful. When I say stressful, because it creates an anxiety for this youthful person that's unemployed, because their parents would be asking them, why are you not employed as yet? And primarily, as the parents are also getting older, this young person is still living with their parents. This young person, when they achieve a form of employment, they have to contend with rent and housing prices that have probably advanced 3 years ahead of the level that they're coming in terms of earning a living. They've got to deal with the inflation of goods and services. I'm talking about like food and other particular goods that have advanced with petrol price influences and other particular inflationary pressures that have advanced those products. Price rates by a good 1, 2, 2.5 to 3 year increase being slapped on top of those products and services. So in some cases, dear listeners, I know when you speak about the salary increase discussion in Namibia, it's always an emotional particular scenario. Yes, because in some people it actually evokes an emotional response. But when people are assessed every year, and you know the various private sectors that they find themselves, if they're assessed every year for the qualification of a salary increment, and they weigh up the value of that increment versus the increase of a liter of milk, of a kilogram of sugar, of a kilogram of maize meal, or just like meat products in a shop, vegetables, fruits. Many people would say, the increase that I got is not worth it versus the daily shopping or the monthly shopping that I've got to endure. I'm actually positioning that particular picture as well in this discussion of youth unemployment, because many young people ask the question of, how can I live if I do get a job? How can I live decently, properly, from what I'm actually making in terms of my employment endeavors? That's a particularly acute problem and discussion to weigh. Now, I'm saying acute because it is a particular pressure point that many people in the youth, specifically from between the 25-year-olds to the 35-year-olds, or let me say from the 20-year-olds to the 35-year-olds, let's use that particular bracket. Not everyone will work in the food retail sectors, even though they are the quickest to expand and to symbolize forms of economic development into areas by constructing, obviously, their own premises, their own trading and distributing points, and primarily also hiring people from the local communities. But when you're looking at the single most important thing about someone starting off in a job, you've got to look at the level that they start off at. I've if for many of you that observe sometimes, you know, new stuff in supermarkets, eh? For many of there's like a couple of supermarkets that I've frequented to in the past 2 weeks, and I've observed, you know, the new faces that they sometimes bring in. You have to be very observant sometimes, you know. You have to be very observant, and specifically us that are find themselves in the journalism and broadcasting and media sector. You have to observe particular trends taking place. There's a couple of retailers in my close vicinity where I stay, and I always observe the trainees or the new staff that they bring in. Most cases with the one particular retailer in the closest, which is the closest to me, there are a lot more women, young women, that they factor into their new cadre or new cluster of employees. Young women. Well, how I see it is that they're always closest. They're always at the cashier, you know, assisting in the packing of your bags. Obviously, if they had to factor in young men, they would sometimes be, you know, in the store facility, storage facility, in the back of the retail shop, of the retail outlet, you know, because they've got to help pack and unpack and transport and move and, you know, do the physical things in terms of filling the gaps on the shelves, as well as also assisting in the storage facility at the back. So that's the particular question, the particular picture that emanates from that. Now, when you're dealing with certain particular developments, and just the one retail store that I'm speaking about, you can literally count the amount of new faces. It's like less than 10 or 10 at most. Less than 10. Less than 10. And the potential illustration, even though they don't give like a real number, they just give you a statistical number. 43%. What was 43% of 2016 back then? Could it be of 2.5 million? Or would it be still of the 2.1 million of 2011 census? What was it? So obviously, this particular picture has its own particular alarm bells associated. No, I'm not. It's not about raising an alarm. It's already been sounding off everywhere else on the continent, including Namibia. Now, it has been pointed out that unemployment amongst the youth is a policy issue. In terms of that, in order to address this issue, it requires an understanding of the youth unemployment in a country, as well as also the objective of a policy, which is to highlight and to analyze the magnitude of youth unemployment in Namibia, and then draw some particular suggestions on how policymakers are supposed to minimize the risk of youth unemployment. So, what was supposedly looked at is the seesaw trend that was observed between 2012 and 2016. So in 2012, Namibia's youth unemployment stood at 37.8%. It rose sharply in 2013 to 42.2%. It dipped back down supposedly in 2014 to 39%. It rose up again in 2015 to 41.2%. In 2016, it actually peaked at 43.4%. Now, this particular indication obviously speaks of that it's continuously going up and down, up and down, up and down. It's not clearly defining which particular sectors or what particular developments in these particular years are actually contributing to this active, you know, up and down, particular picture in Namibia. So, some of the particular takes that are given is literally that after 2016, since the participation rate stayed at almost the same level as in 2014, primarily, this is now the participation level between 2016's youth unemployment or youth employability and 2014's rate. The reason that was given is that the increase in youth unemployment for 2016 can be attributed to a huge decline in the number of people that were employed in the agricultural sector. That meant there were a lot of people that were let go in the agricultural sector, or that moved, that wanted to move out of it. The agricultural sector in Namibia, as we all know, is the largest employer, but it also is the lowest payer. Remember this. It's the largest employer, but it pays the least. Or it has the least potential possibilities, primarily because of the low rate of pay. Now, that particular sector registered a decline in employment of 9.4% at that particular stage. I'm referencing it because in some cases we've got to look at that there might be a sector that sheds jobs and then reattracts jobs. And they shed jobs and they reattract jobs again. And it is that particular ebb and flow that we've got to consistently also factor in. So ebb and flows obviously speaks towards what could be done. What was also measured was that the construction sector in this specific analysis of between 2012 and 2016 of this particular report indicated that the construction sector for years contributed largely to economic growth, which is true because it's a direct stimulant activity. And the employ of semi-skilled and unskilled youth had slowed in 2016 due to a reduced public investment into the sector. Reduced public investment into the construction sector. So that meant that the state, which is the public sector, the state, the government, was a direct contributor to employment opportunities potentially for youth in the construction sector, in the construction sector. I know, I'm, you know, emphasizing and being a slightly bit dramatic, but it actually signaled the particular frustrations that organizations of the construction sector, like the Construction Industries Federation of Namibia, CIF, have actually been, you know, highlighting and indicating primarily that this is a worrying trend. Because if we factor in that our infrastructure development obviously has to somehow be channeled through Namibia's local construction sector, it would greatly involve and greatly alleviate a youth unemployment discussion. Dear listeners, singularly, not enough houses are being built to, you know, combat youth unemployment. And once again, not all youth will be able to work in that specific notion. But large-scale projects or the large-scale construction of projects would obviously tap into this untapped resource, or would actually absorb from this untapped excess labor that's in the market. This is also going to be the same thing that we will all see with the green hydrogen first development phases, in terms of the construction phases or the associated construction phases, because you will see many Namibians being employed. Remember, James Nyupe, the Green Hydrogen Commissioner himself, indicated that you will see so many particular jobs that will be associated to construction and development alone. And then there will be, after that, this is obviously for a fixed, not a fixed term, but I don't want to say fixed term as in terms of implying that it's going to be permanent employment. No, it's only going to be fixed for the specific period. And then there will be permanent jobs that will be occupying the next level of job creation. So you can actually also see, so this is the first one in terms of to build the facilities is going to be temporary based, temporary in terms of it's probably only going to be for a year or for 2 years that these people that will be associated in this construction phase of the facilities, that's the only time frame that they'll have jobs. Now remember, that literally symbolizes potentially a 3 year period of someone being tasked or being attributed to that specific development. Now it obviously will look good in statistical references. It will look good in terms of economic activity because the other private sector proponents, that being the other operators in the private sector like clothing companies, food retail companies, car companies, clothing companies, they'll all realize there's excess money. They will. Let's understand this. They will all realize there's excess money in the market. They will obviously do the necessary calculations and position the resources and distribution points closer to where this excess money is in Namibia's economy. You will see this happening. No, it's literally almost like a computerized, preemptive, behavioral discussion. Behavioral discussion that literally works like it works like clockwork. What you need to look out for this primarily, guys, is whether or not it starts middle of this year or end of this year. Now, don't factor in the elections discussion about it. I know many of you are sitting with the elections discussion at the back of your heads. Don't factor it in. Factor in the particular industrial developments plan for this country. So, when we get to the discussion of, you know, the sectors that need the help, the construction sector would obviously be the first one in terms of getting the necessary assistance because of the planned developments that need to kick off within the specific green hydrogen development phases. So that's the construction. The agriculture would still probably be problematic because if employment conditions in the form of earnings, you know, salaries and wages, were of a level that spoke, you know, that said people can actually earn a decent living from being employed in the agricultural sector. I'm not talking about someone selling the goods at the end to as a street vendor or as, you know, or in a supply chain somewhere else. I'm literally talking about the goat herder, the, you know, the farm hands, the farm workers, the generational farm workers as well, the people that have, you know, they just know this particular job in this particular industry. If you look at the aspect of their involvement, of their discussion, of their contribution, if the element of paying them a little bit better, would symbolize literally the opportunity for people to actually realize that they can do and plan and achieve a lot more in their own personal lives. Now, I'm referencing also at this particular junction a discussion I recently had with Madam Alia Ngula about, you know, what does it look like? And she even made mention of, if you treat people like adults, and if you tell them, I'm paying you, this is the rate of your wages that I'm paying you for, and then you can decide what you're going to go eat and what you do with your money and how you plan your money. That was but one of the particular conditions that she mentioned that she was exposed to in the agricultural sector. We're not even factoring in what other people are doing to their farm workers or to their employees, their agricultural employees. We're not, because we don't hear about it every day. In most cases, many of us continuously speak about, you know, the food security, food insecurity, food production, the green schemes, and the lack of the green schemes' potential not being achieved. But in most cases, we're not talking about what's the scope of employability, of employment, on these green schemes even. Why can't these green schemes, it's not just about growing things. Whoever is in charge of a particular project at a green scheme, why are you not, you know, trying to hire as many people to participate in the particular production phase? We all know that obviously if you add on more costs, this increases the price of the product or the produce. That's a given. That's definitely a given. So, that still means agriculture in its own right potentially has to start pulling its particular weight. Not agriculture from the Ministry of Agriculture side. I'm talking about agriculture in terms of those of us that are involved in agriculture. Thus, indirectly, subconsciously even, have a greater role or take on a greater responsibility of being the opportunity creator in this economy. We've got to do it, guys. Or you've got to do it, for those of you that have plantations, whether it be small holdings, whether it be even in a communal land sense, in a community, yeah, basically. You've got to play a greater role in this regard. We sit with this picture because even in this report back in 2016, there was a significant decline that was also observed in the wholesale and retail trade, as well as public administration, defense, compulsory social security. And all three of them respectively reported at that stage -3.9, -1.4% declines in 2016. Now remember I told you that this particular National Planning Commission report came out after 2016 because it factored information of still 2016, and you need, as a researcher, you need 2016 to complete, you know, to run its course. Supposedly, the prolonged impact from the 2008 economic and financial crisis was also a contributing factor. I say supposedly, because this had also led to limited job opportunities and to high unemployment as well that persisted through. But the question is it still the particular knock-on effect from back then? Or, in the current context that we're looking at things, do we have to start from 2020? As being the particular time frame that leads to this. The other particular reference that I wanted now to tap into was a working paper that African Development Bank Group had authored back in 2013. It's a working paper. If you don't know what a working paper is, dear listeners, it's a paper that explores a particular notion, and it can always be updated, meaning it's not always the final report of something. It can always be updated, or it can always be factored into another particular project, a research project. But working papers assist in terms of saying, this particular anomaly is being studied, and even the anomaly itself can change So that means also the working paper can lead to an updated working paper or an updated version of a report that would then work off the data, the information that was firstly contained in the working paper. So meaning it's like a particular document that says this is not the final or absolute report about a particular event. It can continuously still evolve. So this particular working paper, as mentioned, was authored in 2013 by the African Development Bank Group. And what they looked at in this report was youth unemployment and political instability in select developing countries. Why they looked at this particular discussion was primarily that they discovered that the suggestions internationally were pointing towards youth unemployment makes countries more unstable in general, and it is thus more prone to armed conflict. Now, I'm not saying that in Namibia's context, this is where we potentially might be leading to, but what these guys were looking at in 2013 literally points to similarities that the NSA's census report highlighted. The key understanding out of this is that recent financial and economic crisis that took place when this report was authored in 2013 was obviously the 2008-2009 financial crisis, which led to soaring youth unemployment across the world and in other parts of the continent as well. But what they mentioned here was that the job situation before said crisis was already a major concern in many countries. In Africa, for instance, youth unemployment has been sort of like the biggest ghost haunting us, because it was exacerbated by the additional challenges of a youth population, which is considerably higher than in other regions of the world. So Africa has been producing or has been having youth unemployment rates higher than any other regions across the world. We've been having this. It's not nothing new, even in Namibia's context, but we've been having this. We've also, on the continent, experienced weak national labor markets and persistently high levels of poverty. 70% of the region's population at that stage in 2013 was under the age of 30. 70% of the region's population was under 30 on the continent. And slightly more than 20% are young people that were between the ages of 15 to 24. Now, the North African region, because of 2011's Arab Spring, if you guys remember that, they were the first to see direct, I'll call it a revolt or problematic scenario in terms of, you know, the youth and other proponents or other particular demographics in their population, actually highlighting the acute problems that they were suffering from. So the North African region is literally Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. They, according to this World Bank report, no, this African Development Bank report, had the highest youth unemployment rates and were one in four young people were reported as jobless. One in four. They experienced violent social uprisings, obviously, as I make mention of, during the Arab Spring of 2011, a particular period, wherein young people played a critical role primarily in those scenarios. Now, many studies after this particular picture highlighted that youth unemployment and underemployment are a threat to social, economic, and political stability of nations. These particular studies have indicated that the increasing body of literature about the subject matter of youth unemployment and instability in a country are the causes or on the causes of political instability and conflicts really highlights that this has been a persistent historical event taking place throughout human societies. So when I'm saying human societies, dear listeners, I'm literally talking about the rest of the continent, the rest of, you know, potentially the developing world or the global south. And this is a worrying trend. I'm not sure why any economists have not spoken about this in Namibia, because I can clearly tell you it hasn't been recorded in any of the major media primarily about this. But you will potentially find the similar report that I wrote in today's the Villager e-paper platform, that's obviously being the Friday edition, you will find it in there. This particular notion or this particular indication, as I pointed out to you, literally indicates the fragility in an economic sense, the fragility that exists, that if young people or youth don't have employment, frustration builds up. And frustration is a psychological disposition brought on from a factual position that someone occupies, right? A position of duress, a position of destitution, potentially of hopelessness, of constant anxiety, because they are being asked by their parents why you're not getting a job. They're being asked by other people why you're not getting a job. They are seeing friends potentially getting jobs. They are not getting jobs. They are seeing colleagues, friends, associates, or even family members being invited to interviews. They're not getting interviews. They're trying to look for other avenues and potential pathways of being absorbed into an economic scenario. They can't get through. So the fears are pretty loud. But it's not just the fears. It's the situations that create these fears. Now, what is also pointed out back in 2013 when the African Development Bank authored this particular working paper was that they noted that cross-country evidences suggested that two main lines of theorizing exist. One set of theories stresses the role that political repression plays in driving conflict. Political repression meaning when you've got a system in your country that repress, that literally, you know, creates a negative impact in the country. In this particular view, ethnic groups that experience discrimination should be the most likely to organize armed insurrections against the state. You saw this in Ethiopia. You saw this between South Sudan and Sudan when South Sudan split from Sudan in the Darfur region. The Darfur region discussion. You also see this when conflicts should be most likely to erupt in undemocratic countries and those with pronounced social divisions. You don't have to go far. You'll find many undemocratic countries on this continent. Occurrences in the past 4 years, since 2020, we're talking about Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, predominantly most of the Francophone speaking countries, who all of them have turned to juntas, which are undemocratically elected power grabs. Yes, you have to call it what it is. It's a power grab. They grabbed power. No one voted for them. They're not recognized. So, undemocratically elected or undemocratic systems being imposed, you thus get this particular indication, because the army doesn't know about economics. The army knows about supply and logistics, supply chains and logistics, but they don't know about economics. They don't know about economics because they're not a country. I'll put that to you. They don't know about economics, but they know about supply chains and logistics. Now, the biggest and best example of an undemocratic society that led to the downfall primarily of when you are not looking after your population, which is actually the most well-documented example in the world, is the French Revolution. The toppling of the monarchy and the nobility, the replacement of the military hierarchy, and the removal of the clergy from everyday affairs and lawmaking and law enforcement processes. Because if you have a king, there's no democratic processes. It's a monarchy, that's a feudal system that exists. So, you sit with this particular picture of where are things going, right? Where are they off to? Now, this illustrates when you get to the undemocratic side of things in this particular theory. And according to this African Development Pact, this AFDB working paper, is that it is also likely to happen in less divided societies, but where people feel marginalized because of lack of job or extreme poverty. Now this, you can actually copy and paste onto Namibia. We are less divided. Yeah, there's no clear-cut divisions, there's actually forms of unity. But people feel marginalized. They feel marginalized. Or they are, because there's not adequate or enough access to opportunities. Some of them experience poverty. Some of them experience severe hunger. Some of them experience the nastiness or the nasty impacts of realizing that you should have access, adequate access to money on a daily basis in order to achieve many things. And when I say many things, this is from buying basic hygiene products to food every day and to have necessary disposable income for various other kinds of services and activities. Now, the second set of theories focuses on economic conditions as a paramount rather than political factors. Meaning that in this particular view, poverty and falling income are the keys to sparking potentially civil conflicts. This may either be because poverty breeds armed violence aimed at looting assets and natural resources, or because poor states simply have limited institutional capacity to repress armed uprisings. Remember, this was contained back in 2013. So, what are the particular pressure points that highlights why you get, you know, instability in a country, primarily through the frustrations that countries experience because of a lack of opportunities for their youth populations? It literally speaks to a picture of the clear-cut indication that things continue as they are, if potentially the picture does not improve. Yeah, sure. Namibia would be staring down the barrel of what happened in North Africa. But already, as I mentioned, experiencing a population bulge in the youth employment discussion. Now, I've got to share with you the following particular contribution from this working paper. Now, some studies, or the study of the causes of political instability, has not been as popular in social science papers as it has been as its effects on economies, primarily because this working paper went through its particular literature review, and they highlighted primarily that another study that was done in 2006, conducted on youth bulges and political violence, indicated that the presence of youth bulges increases the risk of conflict outbreak significantly. The statistical relationship holds even when the controlling for a number of other factors such as level of development, democracy, and conflict history are also robust to a variety of technical specifications. For each percentage point increase of youth share of the adult population, the risk of conflict increases by more than 4%. So for example, for every time that we have 1 percentage point more increase of the youth versus the adult population, or as part of the adult population, it leads to an extra 4% increase for the probability of conflict arising in a country. When youth represents more than 35% of the adult population, because Namibia is at 71% in 2024, which they do in many developing countries, the risk of armed conflict is 150% higher than in countries with an age structure similar to most developed countries. In 2000 alone, according to the AFDB working paper, 15 to 24 year olds were representing 17% or less of the total adult population in almost all developed countries, the median being 15%. The same year, listen now about the developing countries, 44 developing countries experienced youth bulges of 35% or above. The same year of 2000, you had developed countries that had 17% as 15 to 24 year olds. 44 countries out of the developing world had 35% and above. 35% and above. Now, it literally indicates that large youth populations or youth bulges are sometimes linked to outbreaks of violence. Sometimes. Remember? Sometimes. Demographic trends and pressures are creating tensions that lead to the outbreak of low-intensity conflict, such as protests or riots. Namibia is already experiencing them, which are more organized political they are more organized political upheavals and internal armed conflicts as well. Now, this indicates that demographic transition is a big challenge for developing countries with large youth populations. Remember, Namibia sits with 71% of people below 35. Namibia sits with 6.8% of people above 60. This indicates to you that there's a massive imbalance. A massive imbalance that obviously speaks volumes in terms of what needs to be corrected, how it needs to be achieved, what needs to be done to alleviate particular pressures. The reason I'm positioning it like this is because if you look at the picture of for example, let's just take yesterday's Independence Day demonstration. It's a reflection of what I just spoke of. It has been building up for 4 or 5 years. Members of Parliament in the National Assembly have been speaking about it. I've not seen enough evidence from the National Council members also speaking about it, because they are similar to the National Assembly participants in terms of, you know, their constituents also can also talk directly to them. This actually also means that many of you can talk directly to these particular representatives that sit in the National Council and the National Assembly. You have to write open letters to them or letters to them depicting conditions of employment or depicting, you know, societal pressures that persist. So, what potentially is also a single most important point is that when you look at the negative aspects, and dear listeners, I'm not being an alarmist. I'm reporting and recording what is being thought of. I'm discussing and sharing with you that there's evidence that people have already observed this particular phenomena and anomaly, and they've been speaking about it. The clear-cut evidence is there. Governments on the African continent do view youth unemployment as a security risk. Governments on the African continent and in the SADC region do view youth unemployment as an instability factor. Remember, we are already experiencing low intensity conflict scenarios, protests and riots. We're already experiencing low intensity conflicts. The question out there is, how rapidly can the policies and the particular interventions that the state tries to roll out be implemented? How quickly can they do this? How quickly can they achieve the necessary particular, if I can say sort of like delivery components? Because they've obviously going to deliver, they've got to deliver things. Even if it's in an election year, things have to be delivered. Because I will outline another particular report, and this one coming actually from the World Food Program in its own right, who authored a particular country brief in April of 2023 last year. This is the World Food Program. Now, they were obviously talking about the food programs, the homegrown school feeding program, the integrated community-based food systems projects, and the cash-based transfers discussion that has also been made mention of many times by politicians in the country. Yeah, literally in terms of how to alleviate the acute pressures that poverty and inequality have been creating. Just some statistics to share with you. The homegrown school feeding program catered for 11,730 school children. Now, if you work on the basis, literally, that on average, a school might have 700 people or 700 learners in it. I say on average, the average spread. If you take 11,730 divided by 700, that would be at least 16.7 schools. 16.7 schools that would factor into that particular statistic. Integrated community-based food systems projects, they had 1,457 beneficiaries. Cash-based transfers, the value vouchers, this saw 3,000 food insecure households. 3,000 food insecure households, which was equivalent to 17,800 people. These are other particular pressures that form part of the discussion that we've been having. Because if you see school children who are hungry, they come hungry from home because there's nothing to eat at home. They are being sent to school to at least have an opportunity to eat. Yes, that means that the state's responsibility has actually expanded. Because remember, if you go and read in the Constitution, the state owns us. We are property of the Republic of Namibia. Us, each and every individual in this country that is a Namibian, that is born in Namibia, you are owned by the country. You are owned by the country. Yeah, guys, it says so. It's a very clear sentence stated in the Constitution. When you're reading statistics like this, now, even though the World Food Program tries to make this look like it's obviously like a newsletter. Yeah, because it is basically a newsletter. The introduction they start out with is literally that an upper middle income country like Namibia has a population of 2.5 million people, and the country has experienced recurrent floods and drought, insect and worm invasions, and the COVID-19 pandemic, which all have had a profound impact on food security, health and nutrition. Insufficient food production and reliance on poorly adapted rain-fed agriculture and external markets for food suggest that poor households are vulnerable to shocks and food price inflation, which is true. Through the Namibia Country Strategic Plan of 2017 to 2023, the World Food Program provided food assistance to vulnerable people affected by shock, ensuring adequate capacity strengthening to the government, and facilitating effective policies and best practices. So this ultimately meant that the World Food Program will always be assisting Namibia. Remember, this is also impacted by a climate change discussion, but literally, it factors in one of the particular feeding, the feeding pressures that leads to the youth unemployment discussion in this country. Because if you ask yourself, if you don't have food at home as a kid and you're sent to school without food, what opportunity do you have to clearly concentrate on your schoolwork? If you are vulnerable as a communal farmer or as a subsistence farmer to environmental hazards like floods, like a drought, like locusts and other insect pests that damage your crops, then you'll never be able to actually achieve a sense of peace of mind in terms of protecting your harvest. You'll never be able to do that. The acute pressures that are outlined here, just in this introduction by the World Food Program's April 2023 country brief about Namibia, literally symbolizes that there's actually a wider problem that exists in this. Yes, they've been catering for 28,000, 29,000, 30,000 to potentially 32,000, 33,000 people. Out of the 3 million Namibians, they've been catering for 33,000 people. Which is good. In my eyes, it's good. Because that means there's at least some programs rolling out. But that does not mean that those are the only 33,000 people in this country that feel the same particular pressure. The understanding is obviously also about this. Is how do things actually look like on the ground as well? Because when I say how do things actually look like on the ground, I'm talking about what's going on. Do people have low earning jobs? Can they really not afford like the basic foodstuffs? Do they know about the various support systems and mechanisms that are rolled out for the elderly, for those that don't have opportunities to get jobs? Because when you look at the scenario in primarily as what is indicated here by the World Food Program, is that Namibia is ranked as at April 2023 when they did this report. Namibia's 2021 Human Development Index was at 139 out of 191 countries. Very low. Very low. Our 2022 Global Hunger Index as at 2023 was at 78 out of 121 countries. Once again, indicating the acuteness of the problems that we face. You look at the picture that took place in terms of where some of these particular projects were being rolled out. The nutritious schools, the nutritious school meals project was held at the Mbora Primary School, for example. Which was a pilot project in the Kavango East region. The project involved setting up a 1 hectare garden at the primary school. The Office of the Prime Minister allocated funds, while the World Food Program assisted with additional funding for the irrigation system and technical support for the project's costing and design. The installation of the drip irrigation system was completed successfully by April of last year, and an official handover obviously took place. The project's primary objective was to encourage the learners at the primary school to consume healthy, nutritious and diverse diets, which was similar to the picture that I saw at the Utasep Primary School, or the school that was that is based in Utasep, that being CJ Brand, there in the Irongo region. It's a primary school. Where it literally now falls on the schools to regularly supply food to their learner populations. The cash-based transfers program with the value vouchers to flood-affected communities back in 2023 also saw, once again, the same two particular proponents, the Office of the Prime Minister and the World Food Program, rolling out a social protection program to assist households affected by floods in the Oshana and Angwena regions. And this particular program was set up to help these communities restore their livelihoods, but also provide access to nutritious food through a voucher program that uses an integrated digital social assistance platform developed in partnership with MTC. Now, this particular program obviously was meant for as a specific disaster response mechanism, because it's a flood, and a flood impacts people that literally try to cultivate or grow, you know, crops. Now imagine if this similar particular entity or aspect was rolled out entirely in an economy, you know, literally entirely for everyone else. Those that feel the particular acute economic pressures around the world. No, not around the world, sorry, around the country. If that is achieved, dear listeners, the opportunity is quite clear and quite alive to literally see a particular manifestation of some form of support to take hold. Not every opportunity, as we are covering these, or as we've been covering these particular discussions, we're coming closer and closer and closer to the realization that Namibia literally needs a support mechanism like a universal basic income grant. Cash in the hand. whether it be monthly or once a year, like the Alaska Permanent Fund, you constantly start gravitating closer and closer and closer to this reality that we need this mechanism. This mechanism is required to alleviate as much acute pressure as quickly or as affordably as possible. I would obviously highlight that one of my particular concerns would be that the food retailing companies would realize, and some of the other particular proponents and the rest of the private sector would realize, that there's once again excess cash in the system, which potentially would lead to a form of an inflation in one or other kind of representation, primarily on the consumer price index of the affordability of certain goods and services for us. The realization, as we continue to observe, to study, compare, and also to assess what's going on in the Namibian context, is that we've got to realize, guys, as something like a dole system or like a universal basic income grant system is shouting at us to be adopted. It's shouting at us to be taken up. It is shouting at us to be the avenue to avert any particular overflowing frustrations from becoming even larger and even more violent. It's shouting at us. The answer is right there in front of us. The answer is right there telling us, do this. Do this. Dear listeners, the aim is not to be an alarmist. The aim is ultimately to highlight to you in the most mellow-headed analysis that a direct intervention needs to be installed in this economy. Direct interventions need to be the spearhead of alleviation of pressure points. We still don't know when things will kick off in terms of the hiring process, to know who would get a job or an opportunity in the construction phases of the green hydrogen sector. We don't know. We don't know. And for how long these people would have the opportunity of working there, we don't know. So primarily, while that is still in limbo and still under wraps and still behind closed doors, interventions have to be brought in today to alleviate the particular pressure points that are in existence. On that note, dear listeners, brings to the end for this evening's discussion here in your number one talk radio station. Do stay tuned for the rest of your programming to follow on after the break.